Thank you for downloading the IA podcast. The episode you're about to listen to was originally featured as a video on the IA's YouTube channel, IA London. But we've taken the audio and we've turned it into a podcast so that you can listen on the go. Enjoy.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to the IA London YouTube channel with me, Mark Littlewood, the Director General of the Institute of Economic Affairs. And I'm absolutely delighted to be joined for this broadcast by John Penrose, Conservative Member of Parliament for Weston-super-Mare and author of this great new publication, Poverty Trapped, which I'm going to be discussing with John. And you can find a link to this publication in the show notes below. John, this is a really, really interesting piece of work. Welcome. Thanks for spending some time with us to talk about the ideas.
Delighted to be here.
So we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about what's the problem we're analysing and a bit of time on your proposed solutions. Poverty Trapped, the byline is, why is poverty still with us after 70 years of the welfare state? What's your sort of audit of where we've got to with regard to poverty in the UK? Are we even measuring the right thing?
And the short answer to that is no, we're not. And the big problem with it is that if you look at the other big problems that we've faced over previous decades, things like mass unemployment or high inflation, most of those are mostly solved. They're not perfect, but they're broadly speaking tamed. And yet, after 70 years of the welfare state, 70 years of the NHS, 80 years since Beveridge's famous report which created all these things, poverty, broadly speaking, isn't solved. It's the one outstanding big problem. And we're spending billions on this every year, and we're not winning. Mm-hmm. And the really annoying, terrible thing is that that's both socially unjust and terrible, and we on the centre-right, in fact, nobody on any political persuasion should accept that as being acceptable at all. But also, even if you look at other countries, and every other developed country is in the same position. Broadly speaking, if you look at poverty rates across the developed world, they're going sideways and have been for decades and decades and decades. They aren't getting better. They're not getting noticeably worse. They jump up and down, but they're not getting better. So even the Scandinavians, who are sort of the poster children of, you know, the best at fighting poverty, they are slightly better, but they're not getting better. They're not improving. They're not expecting ever to win the battle against poverty. Yep. And I just don't think that we should accept, I don't think any society should accept, that poverty is a permanent scar on our society, a permanent long-term health condition for Great Britain or any other country, which can never be solved. That's fatalistic and I think morally wrong.
But isn't the nub of the issue here that we aren't winning this battle because we're measuring the wrong thing? I mean, the UK, Scandinavia, the world as a whole is fantastically richer than it was 80 years ago, you know, measurably richer than it was 20 years ago. But if you're going to measure poverty as a relative concept, it's hardly a surprise you're going sideways. You will continue to go sideways, all things being equal. So this isn't even the metric we should be looking at and trying to crack, is it?
Absolutely right. And the problem is that if you define poverty as we do and most other countries do, as relative income, so how much more you earn than me, then you're never going to solve this. Yeah. What it does do is that metric, that way of framing the problem, leads you to redistribute wealth. And actually, if what you care about is redistributing money rather than solving poverty, then that definition's fine, it's great. And if you're on the left and you like that sort of thing, that's absolutely super. But actually, poverty is different from that. It's a much more fundamental thing. And low income, not inequality of income, but low income is a symptom of poverty. It's not the cause, but it's the symptom. And so what I'm arguing is that the centre-right needs to take this definition head on, needs to take this argument head on and say, we've been doing it all wrong. Mm-hmm. We need to turn the whole system, you know, large chunks of the welfare state on its head and say, how do we instead start dealing with the causes that lead people to be in low income and fixing those causes rather than treating the symptom, which is the low income itself.
So give our viewers, John, some sense of the sort of metrics that you think we should be looking at. I mean, are you focusing here on
the bottom 20% of the population, the bottom 10% of the population? Is your aim to, I don't know, make them twice as affluent over the course of a decade? Give us some very broad metrics here, so, without me trying to sort of pin you to a particularly specific number. But, you know, how are you going to reframe it? Agreed, the relative poverty measure is a recipe for probably equality and more poverty. Mm-hmm. So how do we reframe it differently? What's the other end of the telescope?
Well, there's an entire technocratic industry out there that's doing actually some really important mm-hmm. work to try and back ourselves out of this sort of ideological dead end that we've reversed into. I don't want to sort of try and second guess where they're getting to. It's still work that's ongoing, but there's some really good work being done by people like the Legatum Institute, the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, and indeed the National Statistics Office too, about what poverty really is and how to measure it. But I guess that the crucial thing is, if you think about what makes people prosperous, prosperous is the opposite of poverty. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think that what we should be aiming at is to say, look, everybody, doesn't matter if you're halfway up the income scale or at the bottom, or even two-thirds of the way up and doing quite well, needs to have the opportunity, the same opportunities, to move up further. Mm-hmm. And not just the opportunities, and that means, incidentally, breaking some glass ceilings, smashing them, the things that hold you back and mean that you have a better opportunity mm-hmm. in your life than me, or vice versa. Mm-hmm. We need to smash those glass ceilings. Social reform is crucial. But it also means that we've got to have the skills and the attitudes, that's the work ethic, the ambition, and also the education, to grasp those opportunities, those new extra opportunities, when they come floating past. Because if you don't have that, then you're going to have all the opportunities you like, but you'll never take them.
Yeah. So it seems to me, I mean, this is an overly generalised, too broad brush analysis, John, but the problem we've got is a certain proportion of the population, maybe we could say it's 5%, 10%, maybe higher, 20%, are just sort of stuck at the bottom. Possibly they've got their foot on the first rung of the ladder, but it might even not be as high up as that. Mm-hmm. And even if they've got their foot on the first rung of the ladder, the second and third rungs seem to be beyond reach. What analysis have you made in this paper, and what are your proposals to make those steps up the ladder easier for everybody, I guess, but particularly in this context for those who are at the lower rungs rather than the middle or the higher rungs?
But the first point to make is that actually, in terms of what the social scientists call social mobility, so you're a chance to end up on a different rung of the ladder than the rung we were born into, that our parents were on. Actually, Britain's quite a lot more mobile than everybody thinks. Mm-hmm. If you're a man, your chances of you being in a different quartile of income than your parents is something like 3 in 4.
Right.
So we're a much more mobile society. And if you're a woman, it's higher than that. It's 4 in 5.
Right.
So we're a much more mobile society than people think to start off with. But nonetheless, as I said before, and as you were rightly leading me to, the opportunity is not equally distributed, and it needs to be. So what are we going to do? Well, there's a whole series of proposals in here about how to make housing more affordable. Doesn't matter if you're in the north, where housing is cheaper but incomes may be lower in some cases too, still makes it hard to afford in some cases.
Yep.
Or in the southeast or in London, where both incomes and rents or house prices are higher. Making housing more affordable by building a lot more houses, but building them in the right places, and making sure they're green and have got democratic consent for the local population, so it isn't being imposed on you by bureaucrats or imposed on you by big development companies. Making your home more affordable doesn't just make your income go further, because all of a sudden rent's taking a smaller, yep, or mortgage is taking a smaller chunk of your monthly income or your weekly income. But it also means that you have a better chance of living near to wherever it is you want to work. And that makes you, that creates an awful lot more employment opportunities. It improves your job prospects. And it also, if you're an employer, means that you have all of a sudden much better prospects of finding people with the right skills and getting them to come to work for you, because it all becomes within range for them as well.
Yep.
So housing really matters. Other things matter too, though. So the quality of our education system. Schools are actually improving quite a lot. The academy reforms have made a huge difference. Further to go. But we need to make some big changes for early years. Early interventions really mm-hmm. matter, particularly mm-hmm. if you are born into a family which is one, what they call troubled families, so chaotic lifestyles and those sorts of things. Getting really good early interventions can be transformational and means that you're much more likely to be an independent citizen and yep. a taxpayer later on in life as well, being able to stand on your own 2 feet. But equally, when you get to tertiary, so when you've left school and you're in tertiary education, HE or FE, at the moment, our tertiary education system is riddled with all sorts of snobbery and preferences. So at the moment, we are structurally much more likely to encourage people to go into academic routes rather than vocational routes, yeah. HE rather than FE, to study full-time rather than part-time, which actually, if you've got a job or a family, you need to study part-time because you can't afford to study full-time, to do face-to-face learning rather than distance learning. None of these are necessarily the right things, but they're what we've all inherited, and some of them are really expensive and not terribly effective.
Yep.
So there's a whole series of things, social reforms, structural reforms, that if we do them, we can level up those opportunities and equip people to grab them when they come past.
Let me break some of these down. So let's start with the housing issue. We at the IEA have pumped out material for years and years now on the need for planning liberalisation. There's a million different ways you could cut it, but essentially we see it as a supply side problem. It's very difficult to build. If you freeze the supply, the prices go up, and then you're right, you get all of these knock-on effects that the, you know, London, even though it's a desirable place to work, becomes beyond the reach of many people because the house prices are so high. I mean, we at the IEA aren't politicians. It's our job to think the unthinkable. It's a job for politicians like you to consider what the art of the possible is, or if you can think something a little unthinkable. I mean, we would, you know, scrap lots of the green belt and all of the rest of it, and you always see MBs and residents, you know, blanch in fear at that. What's your sort of practical solution here, rather than just sort of, you know, starting to build, you know, we would probably argue to stop building on Hyde Park and Green Park in London. you've got something here which actually seems like it might have a practical chance of success in the coming weeks and months, right?
So I'd share an awful lot of your analysis of the problem about the fact that we haven't built nearly enough, and that's making it out of reach for either to rent or to buy for mm-hmm. too many people, and that there is a supply side problem, and that the existing planning system is a large part of that, not all of it, but a large part of it. And so sweeping away some of the regulations which stop people building in the right places and make it really expensive and make applying for planning permission uncertain and difficult, and you need to lawyer up before you go anywhere near it, and it's just a nightmare. So I agree with you on the diagnosis of the problem. What I'm proposing here is two things. One of them is something which actually Michael Gove has already said he's rather keen on, which is something called street votes, and that's a really local, hyper-local version. So if you live in a street and you don't like what the local plans are for that street, if you can persuade enough of your neighbours in that street and maybe the one next door, and you all band together and you have a little local referendum and, you know, 60% of you or something like that and vote in favour, you can basically say, look, we are going to declare UDI, we're going to have our own little planning system here, and we're going to define what we can all do in terms of, you know, you can't build more than two stories high and there's got to be a certain style. But if you do that, if you stick to that recipe, then you don't need any more planning permission because it's pre-approved.
Right.
And that means that...
So there'd be like a book of, these are the sort of 25 things you can do. If you want to, just get on with it. You don't need to...
Provide you stick to the book. Exactly.
Yep.
Now, if you're living in a listed building or something like that, you probably need to do a bit extra.
Sure.
And you still need to make sure that you are satisfying building control to make sure it was being built safely. But all the other planning stuff, you would know you were pre-approved and you were bulletproof.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that looks like it's something which is, you know, getting a lot of positive mood music from ministers, so I'm really hopeful that's going to go ahead. But the next size up is to take that basic idea, and which also incidentally has the advantage that it's got local democratic consent. And therefore, you know, you're not having something thrust upon you.
Yep.
And if you build something in your house next door to me, I don't resent it because I can build the same thing.
Yep.
So,
yep.
So we both do well. Everybody wins. The next step up from that is to take that really hyper-local version and say, well, why don't we do it for an entire council authority?
Say Weston-super-Mare as a whole, for example.
Or whatever it might be. And again, it would be the council would be the one saying, here's the recipe.
Mm-hmm.
We've predefined it, but if you follow this recipe, then you're bulletproof, you're okay. And from the council's point of view, the advantage then is that they can also say, well, that makes the council, if they elect to do this, bulletproof from being got at by the housing inspector, so no one can appeal against them to the housing inspector too, which I think will appeal to a lot of councils. But the point about the slightly bigger, less hyper-local version, the Weston-super-Mare as a whole version, or the borough of, whichever borough of London it might be, the point about that is that at the moment, Most of Britain's towns are two stories tall, mm-hmm. most houses, some bungalows at one, some townhouses at three and four, but on average,
generally
two stories.
Two, yep.
So if we say to them, look, you can build up to four stories on this pre-approved pattern book, you know, follow the recipe basis, we will basically pretty much double in one decision on one day the total amount of homes that are permitted to be built in the UK in one go. And it'll mainly be in towns.
Yep.
So it won't be on Greenbelt, mm-hmm. it won't be on Hyde Park, it won't be on
yep.
Green Park.
Yep.
It'll be where we already have infrastructure, so it'll be greener. You won't have to build new sewers. You may have to expand them a bit. And you've already got roads in place and all those other things. And it will be, therefore, the single biggest event of wealth creation and also of reducing the total cost of housing yep. for people who can't afford it at the moment. That's probably happened since the Second World War and possibly before that too. Mm-hmm. So it's a really properly, you know, honkingly big idea if we can just get them to take it on.
Right. But early signs look fairly promising for the street votes.
For the hyperlocal yep. version, yeah.
Now, on the education side, so this government, I mean, all politicians say we want a high-wage, high-skill economy, and you focus a lot on education and skills in this paper. I'm worried that in Britain our university education is more just a screening process to put on your CV for when you actually apply for a job than it's geared to actually making you high skilled. I went to Oxford University, but I was almost told, now you've made it to Oxford University, as long as you don't act like a complete idiot and do actually get out the other end with a piece of paper, that's all you really need on the CV. It's not that you're learning anything specific here that would equip you for the labour market. Is that a problem here, that with higher education it's now just a screening process, it's the CV point, rather than people actually learning skills that are actually useful in the wider economy?
So in most cases, I'm sure it's not. But you are right to say that, you know, while we have some world-class universities with some great courses and really good education, it isn't all like
mm-hmm,
that.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some courses, as I say in here, there are some courses at some universities which leave the students who graduate from them with big debts and small jobs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And for them, that's there's not been a helpful, productive, useful use of their time, or indeed, you know, since they've ended up racking up some big debts, not a sensible
yep.
financial decision for them too. So what I'm arguing is twofold. One is that we should start systematically publishing for both FE and for HE courses, for each course at each college or university. We should publish two bits of information. One is the employment percentage
mm-hmm.
for the graduates from that FE or HE course, so I know what my chances are of getting a job before I start.
Yep.
And secondly, the starting salary.
Right.
Now, if you are 17, or indeed if you're 30 and looking to go to study as a mature student, that equips you with far more information than you've currently got at the moment,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
allows you to compare HE and FE courses. And that means that for the first time, we aren't just depending or assuming that old universities with long-established reputations must automatically be better. In some cases, they will be,
yep.
but there are plenty of new universities, and there are also some FE colleges too, who say, hang on a second, we've got a course in whatever it is that's twice as good as that old ivy-encrusted university
yep.
down the road, and nobody knows about it because we haven't got the brand name to do it.
And just
so we can explode that.
Why isn't that sort of happening at the moment then? I mean, if I was running an FE college and trying to get people to enrol on it, and it actually was the case that if you came and did whatever programme or degree I'm offering, that you're bound to get a job and you're likely to be on twice average earnings within a year or two. I mean, isn't this just a problem of these guys needing better marketing departments?
Well, a bit of that, yes, I'm sure. But the problem with it is that for you to do that, and you can then boast about the fact that you've got great outcomes mm-hmm. for this particular course. But if I'm running the less successful rival college down the road and my results aren't as good as yours, I don't have to publish them.
Right.
So the students can't compare.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So what we need to have is something that says, you've all got to publish it, and we're going to put it all in one great big league table so that you can compare them directly and there's no hiding place.
Right.
The other thing which you also need to do, incidentally, is to make sure that when you're comparing HE courses, at the moment, a 2-1 in English literature or whatever it is doesn't necessarily mean the same for if it comes from one university than another.
Mm-hmm.
Universities are starting to try to change this, and in things like medicine, they're already there.
Mm-hmm.
But there's an awful lot of variation, and it isn't the same as a grade B in a chemistry A level,
which is the same wherever you get it.
It doesn't matter
yep.
where you study.
Yep.
Now, if you said a 2-1 in English literature Doesn't matter what the course is. You know, there'll be different English literature courses at Oxford and Cambridge and Exeter, and then at Middlesbrough. It doesn't matter. So the course can still vary, but a 2-1 is a 2-1 is a 2-1, like a B in chemistry at A level is worth the same.
Then you and get it may some, be that more people from Oxbridge are getting 2-1s, but it would be comparable with a 2-1 from any other university.
Exactly right. And what that would be, and you ask the universities to do this, you don't want government doing it. This is this academic freedom means the universities need to deliver it, get it externally audited, but they do it. But what happens then is that if you or I fluff our A-levels, and we therefore don't get into our first choice university, we get into our fourth choice university, but we work like stink when we're there, we've got a chip on our shoulders, we really want to prove that we can do this, and we come out with a 2-1, it's worth the same as the 2-1 we might have got from the university in our first choice, and we're still just as employable when the employers come looking because they know that they're the same. And what that does is it means that our job prospects are much better, it rewards hard work and industry. It also means that universities that aren't doing terribly good education and are coasting, and there will be a few. Terrible thought, I know, but you know, they won't all be perfect. They won't be able to hide anymore because it'll be clear that actually they've got this really selective intake, and yet why aren't they getting far more 2-1s? What's gone wrong? But also, it means that all those stories that everyone always talks about saying, well, why aren't there more bright working class boys and girls going to university, into decent universities? That will then vanish, because if you're an admissions tutor at any university, you're going to want to find somebody who's bright but whose A-levels aren't quite as good, because then when they come to you and they get the 2-1 having started with 3 B's or 3 C's, their value added is going to make you look great. So they're going to be like gold dust. You're going to seek them out.
Yeah. And I guess this thing would also, you talk quite a lot about the kind of bounce back ability in people's lives. You might have a reversal somewhere. The example you've given here is, you know, perhaps you've had a reversal when you were 18 or you're just lazy or whatever at the time. But that then doesn't act as a shackle on you for the rest of your life. This was an opportunity to bounce back by the time you're 21.
Yeah, it's baking in being a second chance society.
Yep.
And a third chance and a fourth chance society too.
Now, I want to finish, John, by asking you one which I guess you probably wouldn't say is quite as transformative as these huge changes to, say, housing policy or a different approach to education policy. But that's the British honours system, right? And I would imagine that most people around the world look at this and consider it to be an utterly antiquated, weird, mystical mess. And at the moment, you know, my understanding is that there'd be certain positions that you get to in the civil service which then automatically come with an OBE or an MBE or at some point a knighthood. So you're looking at this and saying, well, you know, this isn't meritocratic at all, really. You want to find some way of making this a kind of fair and more open and transparent system of getting your badge from the Queen or getting your knighthood. How would you go about doing that?
Well, you're right. It's not the first thing that comes to mind, but actually, symbolically, it matters. And I think from the point of view of the legitimacy of our society, of our system, and making everybody feel that they belong and that they can succeed, it does kind of matter. Mm-hmm. It's sort of baked into the way we view ourselves as a society. And if you like, you know, bit of British heritage and a bit of history, then it's kind of part of who we are as a country as well. But getting it, modernising it in a sort of post-Brexit, you know, international, global Britain that we're trying to become, I think it's ripe for that. And you're right, what I'm suggesting is, look, we're just introducing a points-based immigration system. So we're choosing the best and the brightest from around the world, and if you get enough points in whatever system, you know, whatever field you're in, if you're really good, then you can come sailing into Britain and we will welcome you with open arms. Now, if we can do it for foreigners, why can't we do it for ourselves? And so my argument would be, look, if you can assess yourself, you know, we'll publish the criteria and say, here's the points you've got to get for being a really good leader of a think tank versus somebody who's a chief, who's the principal of a large secondary school, versus someone who runs a company that's trebled in size and gone international and safeguarding thousands of jobs and created, you know, squillions of pounds of wealth. We'll score all of those objectively, and you'll be able to work out whether or not you're worth a knighthood, because you'll be able to see who's got a knighthood with so many points. And you'll be able to say, look, we know that if it is then Sir Mark Littlewood, we know he's earned it. It's not because of who he knows. It's not because of where he went to school. It's not because he's given any money to a political party. It's because he's absolutely red hot at what he does.
And got these numbers in a range of different ways, right? So it might be some of it's improving the size of your business, employing a large number of people. Some of it could be a reflection of philanthropic work. Some of it could be a reflection of your contribution to literature or research or whatever.
Absolutely right. And the thing about it is that at the moment, some things everyone assumes, but no one can be quite sure because it's not transparent, but everyone assumes that some sectors are very overrepresented and some are underrepresented. So at the moment, wealth creation, for example, not many people get given knighthoods, for example, for creating squillions of pounds of wealth and thousands of jobs. They may then get given a knighthood for giving the money away.
Giving away their profits, but not making
but not
the
for
profit.
Creating it. Yeah. And that just seemed to me to be bonkers. So let's have something where we've all sat down as a society and said, here's what we value, and if you're really, really good, good on you, and we want to celebrate that. It also then means that someone who is successful and gets recognised, that isn't a cause for jealousy anymore, isn't it? Lucky so-and-so, it gets rid of the jealousy
society.
You would
recognise that it had been earned.
It's been earned, it's legitimate, it's to be admired. And that stops the sort of British tall poppy syndrome from ever getting, forever sort of lasting very long.
Now, John, I do want to just finish by asking, how many of your proposals do you think might come to pass? The government's kind of, after the get Brexit done thing has been done, this government's kind of slogan, has been levelling up. And it wouldn't be unfair to say, I think, that a good number of journalists and commentators are saying, well, yeah, if we get levelling up, you, the government, haven't actually defined what it means. We could vaguely understand that, some of the poor areas of the country, those haven't done as well as London in the last 20 years, something's got to be done, but it's quite vague. Is this going to be what the government actually does to level up the country?
I would dearly love it if it was, and I would argue that if levelling up's going to mean anything, it's got to be more than just a public works programme. I mean, yes, it's really important that we invest more in rail. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's really important we build more roads and those sorts of things. So infrastructure matters. Yes, absolutely. But for levelling up to really mean something, it's got to be about opportunity. It's got to be about skills. It's got to be about social reform and transforming our post-Brexit society. This is those ideas. The advantage is it hardly costs the government a bean. So it fills out some of those missing bits that haven't yet been filled out.
Yep.
So I'm rather hoping that they'll pick up at least some of the ideas which are now pre-baked.
And as you say, one or two of them have been picked up already, and the Prime Minister loves his oven-ready, pre-baked ideas. So here's hoping. John, it's been an absolute pleasure having you with us here on the IEA London YouTube channel. This is again Poverty Trapped by John Penrose. Really, really interesting look about how we've been getting poverty wrong over the recent decades and a completely different way of approaching the problem, a kind of opportunity manifesto. Links to it are in the show notes below. John, it's been an absolute pleasure having you with us. Thanks very much indeed. For all of you watching, if you've enjoyed this broadcast, make sure you hit the thumbs up button and also hit the subscribe and notification bell. That way you won't miss any more content from IEA London. If you've got a few pennies spare, you might want to become an IEA online patron. Comes from just £5 a month, helps us keep all of this content on the airwaves. I can't promise you a knighthood or an OBE if you do give us that £5 a month, but you will have my gratitude, and the details of our Patreon scheme are also in the show notes below. I hope you've enjoyed watching this broadcast. Stay safe, stay free. Over and out.